An ancient Korean myth on a 500-year time cycle somehow turns into a very white LA-based kaiju film from the same man that tried previously 8 years earlier with Young Gary. But will this latest attempt into Western markets fail as his previous attempt did? Or, despite not speaking English, can he pull it off this time? But we have a lot to get into this week, so without further ado, this is Kaiju vs. History Dragon War D-War.
Kaiju vs. History. This is your American TV actor jumping into a Korean creature feature for fun, Miles. And joining me is what looks like Darth Vader mixed with the Lord of the Rings Nazgul, Patrick. Patrick, how you doing?
Give me the Ring of Power, Miles.
Or the amulet, or no, the D is what they're looking for.
The scale necklace, is that what it was?
They're looking for the girl.
Right. I knew they were looking for the girl, but like, so, yeah, this movie, we're talking about, of course, D-War this week, which came out in August of 2007. I remember this coming out in theaters.
I feel like I do as well. And like, it's crazy. It had wide release.
It had a very wide release. This I saw part of this movie at the Spartan 16 in Spartanburg, South Carolina. It was a wide release. Like, No, I didn't see it with Jabert. We were kind of just hopping movies or something. I remember one day I was just kind of hopping different movies that summer. And I think we did a double feature of like Transformers and the Alicia Cuthbert Saw ripoff Captive that particular day. But
oh my.
Yeah, so this movie had a very, very wide release, which is pretty shocking since most of our kaiju fare up this point that wasn't an American production does not. Mm. But this was seen in screens all across the nation. Patrick, this movie is, let me ask you, did you watch The Walking Dead?
Yes, I did.
Do you remember the first time Carol enters the kingdom and meets the king?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She has a very specific line, and I don't know if you remember it. It's one of my favorite moments in the entire series. And even when that series completely fell off, I take this line with me everywhere I go for occasions such as this movie.
Okay, what's that line?
Because every 10 minutes I'm thinking, I don't know what the hell is happening in the most wonderful way.
yeah. What? it's so fun to go from this director, Shim Hyung-rae's Young Gary, which is, you know, definitely on the terrible to bad scale.
I believe the academic term is hot garbage.
I think it's kind of still incredibad because
I know you do.
The American actors that showed up knew that they were making a bad movie.
And I don't know if that's the case. And I will die on that hill.
I think there's an hour long documentary on the making of it that you can go back and watch.
I watched some of it. I still don't know.
This movie. We'll get to it in when we talk about our ratings for this one. But you gave Young Gary a 3. Mm-hmm. And I gave it a 6. So that's one of our widest kind of gaps in
the modern era, for sure.
In film. Yeah. It did. The podcast final was a 4 because it was kind of a weak 6, I think. And yeah, that qualifies as bad for the podcast. Not very bad, but it's bad. This movie does a good deal better, but it's so funny. You will start to see the missing scales in this dragon's armor as the movie goes on. But it starts out so competent. I was shocked.
It
really does, Miles. And I'll tell you what, at the first 20 minutes or so when we have this long extended flashback.
A flashback sequence. Within a flashback? Within a flashback?
Yes.
We have Flashception going on here because we're already getting a flashback.
What's a story, yeah.
Oh, because we have this like this news reporter. I do love that we go back to the news reporter, always fun, who sees this scale at some disaster and flashes back to when he was a kid and met Jack, which awesome. Jack's Antiques. Love it. Very, very mystical.
We can't go over all of this movie first. We got to talk.
I know. I have to talk about this part because
extremely competent movie at the very beginning.
Yeah, because this kid then all of a sudden gets like a Princess Bride like situation where he's asking questions about this story he's being told by this monk like guy named Jack.
Yeah,
who is also the reincarnation of like.
Played by Robert Forster pretty well.
Yeah. And, you know, it's fine. But yes. Before we get into the nitty gritty, Patrick, what is in a title? Because this title is ridiculous.
Yeah. So we went with what you can find it on IMDb right now. And I think if you go to purchase it in a few places, what this movie is called, which is Dragon War : D-War. The original title is just D-War.
And that was on the poster.
It stands for Dragon War. So why we
Well, it's like ordering chai tea. You're ordering TT.
Yes, that's a good example. It translated out to a few different things throughout the world. Argentina, Dragon Fury, which is great. And then D-War had a few different subtitles, including War of the Dragons in a few places. And
I thought War of the Dragons is the proposed sequel title.
Well, I think that's what it translated out to as opposed to Dragon War, War of the Dragon.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Places. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, spoilers. Russia.
Oh, the sequel to this day has not come out?
Russia, for some reason, it translated from the Russian to Dinosaur War, which is good. But D-War, I think, is a good enough title, but it's not very evocative. I understand if you were a U.S. distributor that you would be like, can we call it something else?
Yeah, you know, people hear D-War, they're gonna think something very different.
Yeah, but it was so funny is like almost all the marketing material does not actually show like a full dragon. It shows the, you know, we'll talk about it in a minute, but like the Amugi, like serpent like creature. The dragon that comes out at the end of the film is like in none of the marketing materials, I think.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, the little serpents are, I mean, and also the serpents are pretty much the stars of the movie anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, for the most part. Yeah. So it was not very long after the disastrous release of Yongari or Reptilian, the kind of international U.S. release that happened a year later. Director Sham Hing Ray supposedly actually lost money on the project because he had to repay financiers and dip into his own pockets. So you would think after taking a bath on a kaiju movie, he would jump from that concept. He would go to any other genre, but they started in on production. Pre-production of D-War almost immediately after Yongari finished its international distribution. So 2001, they had already had this concept and were looking for more financiers and decided not to film in Korea because Yongari was filmed in Korea, even though it had like zero Korean actors, mostly because they would qualify for a film credit from the Korean government if they did that. So eschewed that because this is filmed almost entirely in California, in L.A., and this new movie would have an even bigger budget than Yongari, which, if you recall from that episode, Miles, was the most expensive Korean film ever made to date. And so this movie, I think, now holds that title as the most expensive Korean movie at $35 million. And yeah, I think it happened because of your Bong Joon-ho's and other Korean directors that were really exploding at the time, not just getting international DVD sales and things like that, but play in markets, in theaters for original releases of movies. And that was, I guess, kind of the idea from the very beginning. So they're back to using English speaking actors. And I think they used more, because it was shot in LA, production crews, which is a good thing because I think the language barrier was a little bit less of a problem with this movie. It definitely
seems like it. I mean, for as many times you're like, what the hell is happening? Like, this movie is infinitely more cohesive and feels more like a movie than Younger does.
Supposedly it started at 35 million and went over budget several times. The DVD release claimed it got almost up to 100 million, which would make this kind of a failure of a film because it only ended up grossing about 75 million worldwide, which is like, you know, like you said, why are they making a sequel if this movie did not do as well and Younger didn't do well? But yeah, they've got great actors in this movie. I told you it was such a delight to watch because every 10 minutes, like a new actor that I could very easily identify shows up in like a super small role or something.
But I will say nothing's more of a whiplash than seeing Craig Robinson like
in his first film. I think this is the first movie he did. He was on The Office at the time, but was not a series regular. He was like,
this was his first full episode.
And he does great. Honestly, I wish he was more prevalent because I feel like directors now allow him to be himself and to inject a little bit more of his.
He's got a couple moments in here, but I mean, also this is so early in his career. He's being paid to do a job. Like he's not, you know, I know he was, you know, probably doing improv and he did the other Office and stuff, but I still did a double take when I saw him pop up at the desk. I was like, what? Like everyone else is not as big a surprise. Like Jason. Well,
I was honestly super surprised to see Robert Forster and really nailing a great performance too.
I don't know why I wasn't shocked to see Robert Forster. It kind of made sense to me.
Well, spoiler warning, Shim Hung Rae had like one other film after this called The Last Godfather. That movie has Harvey Keitel in it and Jason Mewes of
I've almost seen this movie a dozen times because of that, and I have not pulled the trigger on this.
Well, it's so bad that it really ended Shin Hung Rae's career. Like he's not made anything since.
I mean, look, I don't want to like poo-poo or pee-pee on anyone's like talent or career, but you know that may not be the worst thing.
Maybe it's for the best, but
I guess he runs The Masked Singer now, or maybe he popped up on The Masked Singer,
produced some bits of it
in Korea, which is kind of neat. The other people that show up, the one that like stood out other than Craig Robinson was Retta from, you know, Parks and Recreation. Amy Garcia, who you've seen her in a bunch of stuff. She was in the George Lopez Show for sitcoms. There's a lot of sitcom actors on here. I know her as, I think her last name was, she's not a detective, but she's, oh gosh, what is her actual name? I'm blanking out. Ella Lopez from Lucifer.
Yes.
She's like one of the, I think she's a coroner or something. I can't remember. Or she's a forensic analyst, maybe, I think. But I loved her in Lucifer. I loved Lucifer, and she's been in a ton of stuff too.
I didn't really recognize the two main actors. Jason Baer was in Roswell. Was that his like main show?
He was in Roswell. He's the main guy in the American remake of the original Grudge, the Sarah Michelle Gellar movie.
Oh, I completely forgot. They're very.
But he's also Zor-El in Supergirl.
Yes. So that was the thing he did very recently. Very, very forgettable kind of main actors. Sandra Brooks is our main female protagonist. And I don't think I recognize her from much of anything beyond.
Yeah. And apparently she's had things happen in her personal life that have kind of probably interrupted her career. I think her brother was accused of murder, and then she kind of lashed out against one of the witnesses in defense of her brother. And I think her last film was the disaster Lindsay Lohan film The Canyons.
Oh no.
And then she has done some bit parts in some genre shows, and even that dried up in 2018. She's okay, I guess. I mean, I like
her and Jason Baer are both very wooden, and I mean, not saying that they got a great script, but everyone else around them, I think, is kind of elevating
100%.
Bad dialogue.
If I had to describe the two main characters with a television show title, it'd be the whitest kids you know, because the most white people who are somehow reincarnated like Korean legends.
I mean, I guess you could,
which is fine. This has been a story before. We've seen it several times. Bulletproof Monk, Little Buddha, like this stuff has
and
been
this is before. Yeah, this is being it's told fun. By a Korean filmmaker mm-hmm. too. And I will say huge points over Young Gary, because this movie does have a section of Korean history that is great. It's got some wushu action in it. It has,
it's got every, this movie's everything and the kitchen sink.
And it's so funny. It is so much shorter than last week's Big Man Japan, but actually feels longer in some ways.
It does. It really does. Just
bonkers. It is like an hour and 20 minutes.
It's a tight, like 85, 90 minutes.
Yeah.
The official runtime according to Wikipedia is 90, but I think my time on
it has like Amazon was 8 minutes of credits. I was surprised.
I think it's like 82 minutes is about where it was clocked. And I guess I need to be clear up front. This movie is entertaining. And I have to stress that this movie's entertaining, because you're going to hear some back and forth about the quality of this movie or how bad something was or how stupid something was. But first and foremost, the one thing you cannot call this movie is dull.
No, I really, you know, I do think it is kind of rollicking from the get-go, because we're just dropped into it. To be honest, I was totally smitten from the very first scene, because the first scene takes place in like a gravel pit that looks so similar to the one that they used in Young Gary. Miles, I was like, there's no way they're doing this again, sending a reporter to the
maybe it's
pit.
A director's calling card.
I guess I don't know, now
we have to watch The Last Godfather to see if there's a gravel pit there.
Dude, I was dying when that happened, and they're like, you know, showing the
slither marks or whatever.
Yeah, well, just the scale that they were digging up, and they like was all of a sudden filming it. I was like, oh my goodness, they can't do this again. But then, we get the flashback within a flashback, which you alluded to, and
it's look, that the little Princess Bride moment is so funny, because so this kid, young Ethan, I guess his dad's trying to pawn off some dagger. I thought there'd be more to that whole story. There's not. You never hear about his dad again. So Ethan's wandering around, and some chest starts glowing and kind of reveals itself to him. And Jack, somehow, who's the proprietor of Jack's Antiques, is aware of this and fakes a heart attack to get rid of the dad so he can spend one-on-one time with the child, which sounds like the plot of an entirely different kind of movie.
Creepy, yeah. But Robert
proceeds
Forrester
to tell this man he does this harmlessly enough that he proceeds to tell this kid up this ancient legend, and we get a flashback to this whole story. And like, you referenced Lord of the Rings. That was my first thought. Like, Lord of the Rings, also like the Gungan battle from the Phantom Menace.
Yeah, you've got these these ridiculous quadrupedal dragons with rocket kind of firing like, backpacks. Yeah. They definitely look like a toy, you know, a toy that they were going to make after the movie, but they decided to make the toy first. And then, I mean, the rest of the quote unquote dragons in the movie, the rest of the monsters look pretty good. And the CGI looks pretty good. But the main star is the Moogie, this giant snake creature. It really does look like a snake, even though it is supposed to be kind of like a larval, I think, dragon form.
Is it supposed to be more of a classical dragon?
In Korean culture, it probably has more of a base there. But there's a good one that is set to combine with the Yui Zhu, a soul kind of based in, I guess, Korean culture that's supposed to form with the Amugi. In form a celestial dragon. And then there's an evil corrupt Amugi that is either the commander of these forces in spirit form or is just being propped up by the commander. I was a little confused by that, but they're identified as the Baraki.
I am very happy to hear you say that, because there are so many times where I was like, wait, what is happening again in terms of like the story? Cause like there are times where we're like, oh, is that supposed to be the good thing? And I was
they
confused a lot about
very
this.
Similar.
They also do a very poor job of actively telling you like they tell you what's happening in terms of the legend, but like they also don't really differentiate some things, and so it leads to a lot of confusion.
We're told that these are dragons. I think they use the term in the movie, but
they do.
A Moogie is what they're referred to in the flashback, and indeed they are from actually Korean folklore, and they're described as kind of lesser dragons or proto dragons, and eventually would, I guess, mature into the traditional true dragons.
Gotcha.
Yang or Miru dragons that are, you know, they've got like horns, they've got legs, they fly through the air, that kind of thing. These ones definitely do not fly, I don't think, at any point.
No, they slither very, very high. And I kept saying that word, I was like, I know a Moogie, but like she's the mom of Quark. And like that was, I kept thinking of like if like Moogie was like riding one of these things. So like every single time these things popped up, I'm like, oh, it's a Moogie. I was just dying every single time, which is, I know, like on me entirely, but like I thought it was hilarious. We also have, apart from being the whitest kids, you know, Amanda Brooks and Jason Bear are the most LA cast protagonists I could possibly think of.
Oh yeah, most definitely.
And they have trouble emoting, and it makes other actors look silly. Like when, what was Ami Garcia's character name? Brandy. When Brandy's taken Sarah out, who is inexplicably depressed because I guess she's seeing doomsday visions, even though we never are really privy to that.
Right.
Like she just saw the news thing and she was like, and okay. I think
both her and Ethan have kind of like a premonition of being killed or something along those lines. But
The problem is we're still being like, oh, I think this is what it is. The movie does not communicate that well. And for such a cut and dry story, they really should. And so she's off. But there's a point where like Brandy takes Sarah out to a bar to kind of cheer her up. We're going to have a drink, a little girls night. And oh, you know, whatever my boyfriend's name is bringing a friend. He's cute. And then we get like the most solemn response of like, you know, basically saying, oh, I'm not feeling it. I'm going to go home. But like the way she does it is like she had been listening to like The Cure for the last 2 hours. And, you know, Disintegration was in rotation. I have a difficult time kind of relating to these stock protagonists. I think everyone else around them is super fun. I think what's happening is super fun. I do think these two were just wet noodles.
Can you imagine if
they just passed wet noodles instead?
No, Craig Robinson and Retta were the main characters. How awesome
that would be a movie I would 100% pay a ticket to see.
And just like, allow them to make up all their own dialogue.
Oh, I would be in heaven if that were the case. Like D-War 2 needs to be those two people.
Those characters. Right. Yeah. The cast is something else. It's wild. We haven't even mentioned like there's so many super, I would say, well-known, if not popular, character actors that show up in this movie in very bit parts. From Elizabeth Pena is an FBI agent that's in the movie for like 2 minutes. Chris Mulkey is another FBI agent who you've seen in like a dozen things, a million things. He's in so many movies, and we're actually going to see him in a couple weeks in Cloverfield as well.
Yes.
The main.
I do have a question for you, Patrick.
Yeah.
What exactly are these government agencies actively supposed to be doing, and why are they doing it?
Well, there's a giant dragon snake running around, Miles, and the president is trying to get this under control.
It eats an elephant. They're active beforehand, and I don't really understand why. And I blinked. Maybe I went and got a drink or something. I missed where they somehow knew who Sarah was.
Yeah. Well, I forget how they get some information.
Because they somehow know the entire prophecy.
Yes, they get it. I think Elizabeth Pena brings it to their attention somehow, but I don't remember how.
Yeah, no, there's some magical writing happening where like
it's so funny because, and this movie is so good because there are amazingly bad things like that are your brain just glosses over because it is so pretty. The movie looks so professional and like an actual movie, and then you're like, you got to remember the young Gary is behind this.
It shows itself several times, because they do explain who the bad guy, or you know, the Nazgul type of guy is, but not well.
And why has he got to be white too? It's Michael Seamus Wiles is playing the
evil general.
The evil general, who's another one of those character actors you've seen in a million
times. Oh, 100 times. He's been so many things. I mean, and like if you can think of a genre show from the 90s onward, like, I mean, X-Files, Star Trek, Voyager, Roswell, Angel.
He was FBI agent in Breaking Bad. Not a major character, but he was in several episodes.
Yeah, I mean, the relaunch of Night Stalker. Yeah, you've seen him and stuff. He's a good character actor, and he's trying to evoke like a Michael Ironside vibe to me.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, I think he probably had the toughest job, but for the most part, he just kind of transforms into the Darth Vader suit in some scenes, and there's potentially someone else in there doing some stunts for him. But I absolutely, one of my favorite scenes involves.
Yeah. Him. Please tell me about it, because I do like this guy's appearances. I mean, the thing is like, do they make sense? Not really. Like, I guess everyone gets reincarnated in the story. They don't really say why. It's just like, oh yeah, one day you'll get another chance to get this thing right, I guess.
Yeah, just 500 years, you get another chance. Then
I guess everyone is aware at the same time. And it's like, oh, yeah, we're going to go find this girl, Sarah. And so it's got kind of a Terminator plot vibe in that sense.
Yes, but there's no.
Her name is Sarah. I guess.
Yeah, they have no plot. There's nothing for the main characters to do except run away the entire movie.
Oh. 100%. Oh, no, there is that one sequence after, like, I need to clear my head. And they're standing on the beach, and all of a sudden, they just start making out. Like, we know what's behind it. Like, we know they're supposed to be, like, star-crossed lovers reincarnated, but, like, they don't, and they've said 3 words to each other.
Yes. There's not a lot of logic for what's going on here. And all they needed to do was just add in like one little MacGuffin or something for them to like be working towards. But literally they're just running from things trying to destroy them the entire movie. I don't know if you have a favorite scene, but I have several. My favorite scene is when I busted out laughing. I was like, I cannot wait for Miles to see this. And
I do love this scene.
It's when Craig Robinson's driving them away, the main characters, and Michael Seamus Wiles is just in the middle of the road, and there's a CGI car crashing where they just hit him with their car, and there's a hilarious sound effect. And then Craig Robinson gets out of the car and tries to use his magic sword on him, and it just caught me so off guard. In a fairly dull action movie, it's so unintentionally comedic.
Because Craig Robinson's doing exactly what he's supposed to do. He was hired to also be kind of the comedic sidekick in the scenes that he's in.
He's really subdued, you know, if you see him in any other movie.
When I say Craig Robinson's the comedic sidekick, it is not Craig Robinson as you would think of him in a role today.
Yeah.
He is, I mean, and probably was told to play just a hair above straight. So, like, it's funny because it's Craig Robinson and we've known him for the last 20 years, but it's not. I do want to temper expectations. Like Craig Robinson isn't like full Craig Robinson in this movie. So like, don't go in. It's better to not know that he's there. Like for him being a surprise,
it was a great surprise.
It made everything better. So maybe we shouldn't harp on Craig Robinson too much, because I think that's going to drive up some expectations of this movie. but that was one of my favorite parts too. Honestly, one of my favorite parts was the first scene that the camera pans to him. I'm like, I nearly spit out my dream. I'm like, oh, it's Craig Robinson.
Yeah, exactly.
What's he doing here?
The exact same response out of me. My goodness.
One of my favorite sequences is when Mr. Belafonte, who is a guard at a zoo, who survived attack by one of the Amugi because the Amugi was eating the elephants at the zoo.
Just kind of biting them. It didn't seem like he was taking chunks out, you know?
Yeah, there's that too. They also don't seem to eat people. Like, they they bit Brandy, Sarah's friend, and killed her, but then just dropped her off in the pool.
Yeah, and we don't, there's a scene of her body floating, but it is not, it doesn't linger on it long enough for you to actually tell that it's like a body. It's
and like she's so never short. Mentioned again.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure she's dead, but
but like no one says, oh, by the way, your friend who was, you know, deeply involved in your life.
Well, they're literally running for their lives the rest of the film.
I understand that, but I would hope someone would have brought that up to me. But so this security guard has apparently tried to tell people about the giant snake that he saw, as he puts it. And they put him in a straitjacket, which is not something that really ever happens. And certainly not in 2007. Not for something like this.
Yeah.
And
I saw a giant snake. It's not like, oh, you're going to harm yourself.
Well, yeah. So the interview he's having with a therapist, the hypnotherapist, I think, is hilarious.
The hypnotherapist is later. That's just like a regular therapist.
Oh, yeah. This is just a regular therapist. So the therapist is like, if you just say that you didn't see the snake, we can move on. And I'm like, well, that's not how therapy works.
Admit your delusions are not real, and then you can get out of the straitjacket.
He's like, fine, I guess, you know, I was overworked or whatever, and I didn't see a snake. At the same time, this snake is popping up in the window and kind of hissing at him.
Well, and it's like,
but his reaction is so, the delivery of the line, I can't remember the specific line. He's like, oh, good, the snake is back.
I'm sorry, doctor. I'm sorry to say it, but the snake's right behind you. And of course, she turns around and it's just moved away.
It is.
But it's like it's like 100 million ton thing, like sitting on the building,
which is shaking like, the building.
They're not hearing it like, cracking the walls and things like that.
That the comedic delivery of that line was A++. I died. So it's my favorite part of the movie because it's so stupid. The entire scene is so stupid.
Billy Gardell plays Mr. Belafonte. He's Mike from Mike and Molly, and he's funny, but I don't like that part that much.
I don't know why it works for me, but it just killed. I was dying.
The cast in this movie is, I think it's worth the ticket alone, because it's like, what if Troll 2 had like some of the best actors? You know, the dialogue is so clunky in parts, but they're making it work and playing it straight. And it's amazing. One thing I wanted to, there's a couple things I want to point out, because there's a lot of history in making this movie, and it's fun that it was made here in America. You know, besides the stacked American cast, I think one of the most important characters of this movie is the USA Bank Tower, which is featured in the posters, the production art. It is the main tower that a lot of the action takes place around towards the middle of the movie. It's not even like the beginning of the third act, but it's when the giant snake coils itself around the movie. And first of all, what a lie that it has in several posters two snakes like fighting at the top of that building.
Yes.
In like a dragon war, because the second snake does not show up until the very end of the film.
Correct. Which
I was so bummed by that.
It is extremely disappointing.
But the US Bank Tower, colloquially known as the Library Tower, and I think it was referred to as Liberty Tower in the movie, is a pretty famous building. It was in Independence Day, a lot of destruction and kind of apocalypse movies. So The Day After Tomorrow, 2012, San Andreas, and looks great here, and looks great being kind of wrapped around by this giant serpent. But fun little point, at the time, this was the highest skyscraper helicopter pad in the world when this movie was made.
Interesting.
So, and they actually use it for a helicopter pad, which is kind of fun. They don't make it very far in that helicopter before the snake gets them, but it's such a great set piece. And I was happy it made it into the movie, and it's an actual, you know, place and not made up. They actually filmed on top of it, I imagine. So cool stuff. Another thing I want to point out, my research from the New York Times article about this, the advertising for this movie was crazy. Do you remember the trailer and things when it came out?
Yeah.
Besides, I guess, video, you know, television trailers, movie trailers, things like that, from the New York Times article, Mr. Shim persuaded corporate titans to invest in the film, in part by appealing to their sense of nationalism. So got Korean brands to kind of take part. Quote, over dinner with a Samsung executive, Mr. Shim asked the company to play trailers for Dragon Wars on its TV sets on display in retail stores. Something was going to be playing on those TVs, Mr. Shim said. Why shouldn't it be Korean content? And as a result, the dragons are roaring at more than 180,000 TV sets in shopping malls across the United States. And that reading this article triggered something in my brain. It's like, I think I remember seeing them Best Buy.
Yeah, I do remember them at Best Buy for sure.
And I was like, what is that movie? Because I did not see this when this came out. But that is a hilarious little tidbit about Korean kind of pride and sticking together, and probably was done for free, I imagine. I don't think this is something that came out of the production budget, but super interesting. This movie is wild, Miles.
Yes, it is. Wild.
One other thing I wanted to point out before we get into the end game for this is pretty great score. I don't know if you really caught on to it, but Stephen Jablonsky did the music for this movie, who's a contemporary of Hans Zimmer. He works with Michael Bay mostly, so he's did all the music for the Transformers movies and a lot of other Michael Bay projects. And while I think the sound editing in those films is atrocious, the music is usually on point. Pretty good in this movie too. Right. So getting to the reviews of this.
Oh boy. It has
a 29% on Rotten Tomatoes, 90% audience score, and has a...
I said 90?
19.
Okay, 19. I was like, okay, that makes more sense.
Letterboxd has 1.8 stars, or like 3.5 on our scale of 10. And it's crazy to me because Young Gary has 2.3 out of 5 stars on Letterboxd. Young Gary is like more liked there. And on IMDb, it as well has a 3.5.
Young that Gary is insane 2.7. To me.
They're very close in a lot of places, which I do not understand. I think this movie is so much more enjoyable.
Yes.
In 2016, they announced a potential sequel to the movie, which if it still has an IMDb page, D-War 2 Mysteries of the Dragon. And the last time they said they were going to start filming was 2016 for maybe a 2017 release. Obviously, that never happened. We'd be talking about it right now if it did. But they're still working on it. Did you see what the suggested plot for the movie was going to be?
I did not.
Okay. Well, if you had a guess, what would you think a sequel to this movie would be?
I don't know. I mean, I guess maybe Ethan's trying to find Sarah again.
Oh, you think the main character's coming back? No. The new film was supposed to be set in 1969 and depict a fictional war between the U.S. and Russia as they race to be the first person to land on the moon.
What?
Yeah, I'm
not
sure.
What does this have to do with the dragons?
This is from IMDb, and I don't know.
Which is not the most reliable of sources.
I don't know where that quote comes from, but I want them to understand how terrible an idea. Why would there be a dragon in that?
That's what I want to know. Like, where
does
this
make sense for a sequel? I kind of wish they would go the Jason X route.
Well, yeah, if there would be dragons in space or something, that's, you know, I'm all for that.
Oh, that quote is from a Variety article that was written in 2016, and that's why it's on the IMDb page. I don't understand. I don't understand why. Go the Jason X route because it happens every 500 years. Make the next movie set in 2507, and then we get dragons versus giant mechs and spaceships and fun stuff. But
yeah,
1969 space race. Why? Why prequel? I'm so confused.
I am very, very confused. I do not like that.
Let's get to our own rating, Miles.
This was a roller
coaster of emotion. I'm upping my enjoyment score because I enjoy this just as much as last week's movie. It is very much a roller coaster. It is the definition, I think, is 100% so bad it's good kind of film. I would say this goes into so bad it's great territory. And I think I appreciated it more having watched Young Gary before. My disappointment that we didn't get to see the two giant snakes fight on top of the building in all that promotional art is docking this a few points, but
Mm-hmm.
There's just so many similarities as well with Young Gary that I really liked thinking of this as a, you know, watching these back to back, I think would be a lot of fun for people. How bad that movie is and then how kind of better polished this one is. So I'm giving this 9 out of 10. What about you, Miles?
So I think first things first, this movie really sucks. This movie really sucks. I have to stress that.
It is one of those times I don't argue with people that give it pretty low marks on online.
That said, this movie is extremely entertaining. Mm-hmm. And I wholeheartedly, like, I don't always agree. Like, you and I have a bit of different kind of barometer for So Bad It's Good, which we just have different versions of it for ourselves. Mm-hmm. I 100% line up with you on the So Bad It's Great scale here, because you will have a great time, and it can be a great time hating the movie. Like, it almost invites you to do so. But unlike Young Gary, it's an enjoyable time. Like, I am having a great time, and like it's featuring writing that's like barely competent and then barely incompetent. So it's like just enough to be like, okay, that's stupid, but like I'm still along for the ride. And then like none of this makes sense, but I'm still along for the ride. And the fact that this still takes you on a ride and that it is very entertaining, even when it's being a movie that absolutely sucks, like, is this is what I want from So Bad It's Good. Like, this movie is a blast to watch. So I am right there with you from personal enjoyment. 8 out of 10.
I really wish I'd seen this in theaters, because I would have walked out and been like, what?
Yeehaw.
I mean, we didn't even talk about the ending, like much of a bummer the ending is. It just ends with the dragon.
The ending does suck. Like, legitimately, the ending
sucks. Off into the sky. Yeah, it just doesn't feel like anything's really resolved.
And it ends with him like walking off in the desert.
Yeah.
And like she became the dragon and then disappeared.
Technically, I think this is one of the most competent kaiju films to ever come out of Korea. Not that that's like a high bar.
There's like four.
I was about to say, if we're fully counting. And one of them includes
the best child ever in a kaiju film.
But if we're including the host, obviously it's not the best, but it is hilarious. This comes out 1 year after the host. I enjoyed the directing for the most part. I really do feel like Shemhong Rays has some very odd editing and stylistic choices that made it from Young Gary to this movie. But I feel like he was leaning on American Crews to really help him with some of the script and dialogue. Mm-hmm. That
absolutely
just a million times better than Young Gary. And the graphics, we didn't even talk about the graphics that much.
Yeah, we didn't.
They look amazing. Yeah, they look actually still look good today in some of the mix of physical special effects, like, you know, building walls exploding and then the dragon like just kind of like appearing, and it looks great. The dragon looks very good. I kind of wish that, like I said, we got more of both the dragons in daylight, because their fight is at night for the most part. Mm-hmm. But all these, like, the vast majority of the action in the movie takes place during the day, and some of the CGI is a little rough around the edges, but the main monster is amazing. The practical effects that they do in the film work really well. I'm surprised they had like actual tanks, actual, you know, great production value in the actual dragon war that takes place, and yes, great explosions too. It felt like a Michael Bay movie at some parts. The script needed a second pass because, like I said, it does have these a nonsensical kind of like action movie plot of just run away from explosions and everything will be fine. And the dialogue is a little wooden in parts, but I'm not dinging it too much for that. I'm giving it a 7 out of 10 for its technical aspects, because for the most part, this movie is so polished and so much better than Young Gary. I was blown away when I watched it. I was expecting something much, much worse.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, I side with you on the fact that, yes, this movie, the mixture of practical and digital effects work really well. It is very polished. The things that really ding it for me are, one, the two protagonists being just complete milquetoast characters and actors. They're not great. They're not interesting. That's the thing is, they're not great. They're not horrible.
Yeah, if they were a little worse, it would be better, which is hilarious.
I 100% agree.
A little closer to the room, like their dress. We didn't mention, but he is dressed terrible the entire film. He looks
like a moron the entire film. And if someone doesn't take a razor to his face and oh my God, he looks like an 18-year-old trying to look older.
That's a pretty good description. Yeah.
And I mean, it is horrendous. And he is terribly dressed and she's not much better. I've already talked about her acting and her overacting, but so they really do kind of help sync the movie a little bit more. And yes, this script is bad. Very, very bad. And it's the fact that it's a so bad, it's a good movie is one thing. But if I'm just judging this on its technical stuff, this script sinks the movie. Like, because so much of this movie works. Like you have a great lineup of supporting actors who help keep this movie afloat. You have pretty solid effects. You have, at least a coherent story, which is better, more than what I can say for Young Gary, even if there's like some very, very thin, like one line excuses as to why certain things are happening. Like they are present, but that script is bad. And the two leads are bad. So I'm actually going to, it bad enough to where I'm going to mark it a little bit lower and give it a 6 out of 10.
Okay. Yeah. No, totally understand that. What about where it stands as a piece of important kaiju filmmaking? Where does it stand in the entire pantheon of kaiju movies? What do you think about that?
So this movie's, I mean, again, we've talked about this movie's a blast to watch. It's certainly not awful to watch. Does the movie suck? Yes. But like, it sucks incredibly. That's a weird phrase. Never mind. It
sucks incredibly good.
It's a blast to watch. And so that certainly elevates it. That said, look, I love seeing a kaiju story coming from another country and from, you know, a Korean voice. That's cool. But this movie, as much fun as it is incredibly forgettable. I mean, I don't know if I'll remember much of this movie next week. You know, if you ask me, oh, yeah, you've seen D-War. Yeah, I've seen D-War. It's pretty fun. But like, it's never going to come up again. It's never going to sit in my brain pan. And that really, I mean, kind of like Big Man Japan. We talked a little bit about that one not having any staying power. This one already kind of flopped when it came out and no one's mentioned it since. I mean, I would imagine other than like another kaiju specific YouTube or podcast, we're probably the two only people talking about this movie.
Yeah, the silence is deafening out there for D-War.
So for Dragon, I kind of like, for cultural relevance, it's severely dinged. But for it being a fun movie in the kaiju canon and doing something, you know, neat, you know, not like Daimajin, but like kind of in that kind of style, using like classic or old legends from the culture, and you know, making a monster movie out of it, I'm a fan of that. So I am literally in the middle of the road. I'm going to give it a 5 out of 10.
That's exactly where I'm at with you. 5 out of 10, which is pretty funny. I think this is going to hurt it in the long run. But again, while you're talking, I was just thinking, you know what this movie feels like, Miles? It feels like an asylum film that was given a $100 million budget.
I literally was thinking the same thing when I was watching this movie. I was like, it felt like an asylum movie, but like with more like effort into it.
Can you imagine if they had great actors and production value?
If every asylum movie was like this, they would be my favorite company.
It's still so bad, and it's amazing. It is one of those movies. I can't give it any more than 5 points.
I am right. Look, but, like, if people look at the scores and see that for personal enjoyment, we both rated it very, very high. Like this movie shouldn't get any more than a 6. Like it really shouldn't.
Well, that's where it's going.
Well, good, because it shouldn't. Because the parts of all the holes, this is a 6 out of 10 movie at the very best.
Yeah, but it's on the cusp of getting a 7. But
a 6 out of 10 can be a blast. Look, I know people who love, like, for example, last night I rewatched Killer Clowns from Outer Space, and I may give that, you know, a 4 out of 10. I mean, sorry, a four out of 5 stars on Letterboxd because of how much I personally enjoy that movie. But if I had to break it down amongst this stuff, actually, I'd probably still get a high score because it does have an importance to the horror history and it does have really good technical effects.
Got the Chiodo brothers.
Yeah, but it may not have an equivalent to an 8 out of 10, you know, something may have, you know, well, that one probably is a bad example, but I have friends who give that movie three stars and be like, oh yeah, it's a fun movie, but like, it's not a good movie. And that's fair.
I think in Korea, this is like an 8 out of 10 movie, because this is a capstone for giant monster movie making over there. And, you know, Shim Hyung-rae used an in-studio, his own production company for the special effects. And I think that should be celebrated. Yes. I think that is one of the things that should be kind of lauded in his vision. And his vision came to be. And we got a movie that is probably, you know, he as a director has improved a million times since Young Gary. It is a much more palatable movie than Young Gary. But yeah, watching back on this, it really does make me think that this and Young Gary are some of the best, worst movies to riff on. I think it's just a poster child for MST3K. Riff Trax has done a Dragon Wars riff, which I need to watch next. I will rewatch this movie for that. But
I mean, that sounds fun.
I want a Young Gary as well. So I'm at a light 7. You're at a heavier 6.
Solid 6.
Final score. That is going to bring our podcast final to a 6 out of 10. Which, yeah, it's right there on the edge of a 6 or a 7. But
where realistically belongs.
Yeah, I feel like 6 is probably better for. It's a good movie. It's actually good, which is surprising. Once again, yes. we gave the last movie a 4 out of 10. Young Gary. So I'm happy to finally talk about it. I was beaming when I watched this movie, though, because I was like, this is so wild. I can't wait to chat about it. And it's definitely one. It's another one like last week, like Big Man Japan, that I want to show friends and subject them to it and have them go through the same.
This is certainly one to like make people like have some drinks, have some fun, have some brownies, and watch this movie. Absolutely.
I need a double feature with Young Gary. It will change your life.
I would be against watching Young Gary. I will be doing something else.
Miles, that's going to do it for us. Where can folks find us if they want to chat kaiju stuff?
Yeah, if you want to email us, you can email us at kaijuversushistory@gmail.com. You can tweet to us at kaijuversushistory on Twitter or X or whatever. Anyway. Visit our website, kaijuversushistory.com. Check out our Letterboxd account, kaijuversushistory, see all our reviews and watch all of our list of films, and rate and review our show. Comment, share with your friends, and let us know what you think, please. Patrick, what are we doing next week, buddy?
All right. Thank you, Miles. Thank you, listeners. We're going to catch you next time when we start in on a new trilogy plus one of films reimagining the classic television series Neon Genesis Evangelion, a series that will take over 14 years to complete. That's right. Tune in next time for History versus Evangelion 1.0. You are not alone.